Blog Talk Radio.
The following broadcast is brought to you by the iGolf Sports Network.
Golf Talk Live is sponsored by the iGolf Sports Network and Golf Tips Magazine. Here's Andrew to tell you more about our sponsors.
iGolf Sports is a live stream broadcast and media production company providing quality programming designed to attract the golfing enthusiast. And Golf Tips, the game's most in-depth instruction magazine, including reviews on the latest equipment, tips from top teaching professionals, all designed to help you improve from tee to green. Welcome to Golf Talk Live with your host, Ted Odorico. Join Ted each week as he speaks with some of the best in golf. This week's special guest will join us a bit later. But first up is another great discussion on Coach's Corner. So let's introduce tonight's Coach's Corner panel.
All right, good evening, everybody, and once again, welcome to Golf Talk Live. And yes, we are live this evening from 6 to 8 p.m. Central or 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time for those of you on the East Coast, and always excited to have you guys join in. We got a great show for you tonight, as always. We're going to be talking with the gang, if you will, on the Coach's Corner panel, and I'll bring them out here in just a moment. And a little bit later on, I'm going to be joined once again by my very special guest, who is a world-renowned golf landscape painter, Linda Harto. She's going to be coming on the show on the second half, so I hope you'll stick around. But always glad to have you guys join in. As I mentioned, we are live every Thursday evening, and the best way to find us is go to blogtalkradio.com/golftalklive is the link. Lots of other great places you can tune in. You'll hear about those at the end of the show. But you just go there, scroll down to the if it's live, you can it'll come up right on the main part of the page. But if you miss it, or tune in a little bit later and you want to hear the entire show, you can go to that link, blogtalkradio.com/golftalklive, and scroll to the on-demand section, and you'll see it front and center right there, and you can listen to it its entirety a little bit later on when it's convenient for you. So, but thank you for joining us again, and I'm going to introduce the Coach's Corner panel. We'll get into tonight's discussion. All right, first up is Tim Kramer. He is a Visionary Peak Performance Mind Coach, president and founder of Peak Performance Mind Coaching, a program utilizing innovative and pioneering mind coaching techniques. And he's also a contributor editor with Golf Tips Magazine. Also joining the panel is Alicia Larson. She's a Class A LPGA teacher professional, founder and president of Gratitude Golf, currently head professional at and director of instruction at Marcus Point Golf Club in Pensacola, Florida, and author of The Missing Link, The Powerful Role of Self-Talk in the Mind Game of Golf, and coaches every golfer from beginner, intermediate, up to the advanced players. And coughing in the background is my good friend Clint Wright, a 30-year member of the PGA, one of the partners at TGM Golf, who, of course, are a big proponent of the R3 approach, considered, in my opinion, to be one of the best in the short game today and a favorite panelist here on Golf Talk Live. So, guys, welcome to Coach's Corners on Golf Talk Live.
Good evening.
Glad
thank
we're here.
You.
Thank you.
Well, glad you guys could join me. Clint, are you going to be all right, or do we need to give
you
a break?
I'm surviving. Yeah, I'm surviving. I'm surviving.
No, not a problem. It happens. So just before we get started, Tim, I know you said you wanted to plug something. Did you want to do that now, or do you want to wait at the end
when you let everybody know how to reach you? It's ironic, you know, as we talk about the mind game, one of my guys, somewhat of a former student, but we still stay in touch, just shot 57 in a professional event out
wow.
in Vegas. And then
wow.
the following week went and won the Arizona Open. So it's just always exciting for me, and especially with Alicia on the panel tonight. I know that we know, and Clint too, is a huge proponent of the mind game, and I don't even know what we're going to talk about tonight, but I just got to say that, you know, increasingly in all the sports, we're just starting to see the importance of the mind game blending into physical performance, and as a coach, that's always very exciting for me.
Well, congratulations to that young man, and I think he needs to get to the craps table or something, or blackjack table
yeah.
pretty quick, because he's having that kind of luck.
Well, that's probably
try
true.
His luck
yeah.
or on one of the slots or something. I don't know. All right, very good. Well, you can mention some more if you like at the end. All right, so I'm going to go – some of the questions I'm going to have you guys each take a go at it, and you'll understand why, and some of them I'm going to pose individually. The first one is one that I'm going to ask all of you. I'm going to do it in the order that I introduced you. So, Tim, I'm going to start with you. The best tip that you ever gave a student, what was the best tip, do you think? I'm sure you gave a lot of them, but what was one that stuck to mind?
Yeah, I got to say that just the idea as a mind coach that everything you're telling yourself becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if you can't get your thoughts and your imagination out in front of results and performance, you really kind of have no chance. If you're sitting there with a lot of doubt and negative self-talk and whatever, it just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that's what you see in your results.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Very, very good. Alicia, what about you? What's again, I know we've all given many good tips, but sometimes there's a few that stick out to mind, and obviously a lot of it depends on the reception of the student, how they receive it. That's obviously, I think, a given. But what's one of the best tips, do you think, that you've ever given a student that you can recall?
Well, I guess I would put it – I hope you can hear me because I'm in my car traveling, but I think that for me, obviously, what was just mentioned about self-talk is that would have been probably my number one thing. But, you know, I always ask my students if I said to you what you say to you, would you allow me to be your friend? And everybody that I've ever asked that would say, well, no way. You know, there's no way I'd let anybody talk to me like that. And I'm like, well, then, okay, so let's talk about that, you know. So that would be that really gets to the core of people in my it's right under the surface. They know that they're mean to themselves, but they still do it. And if you can kind of tap into that and kind of reverse that, it's really, really, I don't think as golf professionals we can really make the progress that our students want when we're standing in front of them if they don't address that issue. I really don't feel like there can be anything that can be achieved or even try to reach your full potential by having that piece really in place. It just has to be addressed. The other thing is, I would say, I think tip-wise, if I really honestly feel when I work for Golf Digest schools and they emphasize that, you know, a large percentage of the problems that people encounter with their golf swing are something they do before they move in their fundamentals. And so I really have focused on that with the masses and said, you know, let's just go for those first. And it really does improve people, and they – You don't have to have it be a major undertaking and an overhaul of their golf swing, but just some subtle changes here and there with their fundamentals, and it really can make a difference. And equipping them with the knowledge of what the fundamentals and how they can affect positively or negatively their game. So I think I've really enjoyed, you know, teaching people about the fundamentals of the game, you know, in general, just starting off. And then of course you have to go to the movement and everything else once you move, but That's been very helpful for the masses for me.
Very good. I like that answer. Definitely some words to live by. Clint, what about you? I know you've had some good tips as well that you've shared over the many years that you've been teaching as a professional. Any one that maybe sticks out to mind? It might be one that you've repeated a lot to a number of students, but is there one particular that you can think of that really stuck out?
It's real simple. Let's start with the putter. What do you think? You know, when you get a student come up, all they want to do is bang balls. And I start my lesson programs off over the years, and I've kind of refined it down. That's all I work on anymore, is we're going to start putting, because I always ask the student what the objective of the game is. And, well, the objective of the game is put the ball in the hole. I said, all right, well, let's figure out how to do that first. And then we can keep scoring. So really just more of a, not a tip, but more of an improvement strategy that we kind of instill in our students. First off, is if we're looking for a better score, we got to figure out how to put it in the hole first. And then we can figure out how to get up there in less shots. So not necessarily a tip, just a strategy for improvement. Mm-hmm. And we always start people off putting to figure out how to put it in the hole.
I think that's a great answer as well. Sometimes getting direct to the point. I think is the best way to handle it. I think sometimes, as you're right, Clint, I think a lot of students, think that they need to pull out the driver and see how much more distance they can get. And, you know, it's nice to be able to hit the ball long, but at the same time, if you're not in the fairway, if you're not keeping it in the short grass, you know, a driver sometimes is not your friend. So I would be much more inclined and rather be more proficient on the putting surface, because that's where you're going to score your shots the majority
certainly.
Of time. So well said.
That's right.
Let me ask, I'm going to ask this one here of Alicia. I'm going to start in a different order this time. Alicia, let's talk for a second about bunker play. This is a nemesis for many golfers. What can we do to make it easier for amateurs to hit out of the sand? Why do they have so much tough time doing that, and we look at the pros on television and they make it look so easy? Why is it so easy for the pros? Why do the amateurs have such a tough time?
I strongly feel that the amateur player isn't aware of the importance of the entry level. Well, first of all, they're, you know, just their setup and everything, but the entry level into the sand, so you can, you know, I'm sure this is a drill that every golf professional has given people, where you draw a line in the sand and you know have them see visually where they're entering the sand, and that helps their, you know, visual. But I also think the experiential side of feeling acceleration is you have to be stronger out of the bunker, and you know they just don't take that sand and finish. They, you know, they're going to take sand and not finish, or they're going to finish and don't take sand, and that's the entry level thing. So I think that, you know, Dave Pelz, when he made me be a proficient bunker player and I had to stand, you know, in the sand and have him watch me for hours, he had me hit 3 irons out of the bunker and, you know, lay that baby wide open, and you have acceleration with a 3 iron, and it, you know, that gets you to be a really good bunker player for sure. And I mean, you know, when you're standing there with Dave Pelz and he's watching you for hours, you know, you become a pretty good bunker player. And but I it was about acceleration. He really honestly felt that, you know, if you accelerate with your bunker shots, it's actually going to help your full swing. And so that was kind of his mindset relative to the schools that I went to when he was there. So I think entry level and just the acceleration and the strength that it takes to get out of a bunker. You know, they got to keep moving through that sand. Club's not hitting it.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting because I think a lot of golfers, too, forget the fact that they're not hitting the ball first in a bunker shot. They're hitting the sand. And,
right.
You know, so there's that sort of connection is lost, if you will. And it's always interesting, too, you know, you mentioned about really having a good follow-through and, you know, where we see a lot of golfers – tend to kind of just thump the club into the sand and then all of a sudden stop. They're not actually having a follow through. And obviously there's certain situations where that might be applicable. If the ball is plugged, you might not follow through quite as much. It may be more of a thumping action, if you will. But, you know, it's funny because you watch them hit on the hard surface on the ground, and they'll swing for the hills. And in a bunker, it's like this dainty shot that they're trying to hit. In their minds, and it's like there's no effort whatsoever. So it's just kind of interesting. It's always been, I think, as I said, a nemesis for many golfers. So you, I think you explained that quite well. And, yeah, it would be very intimidating to have somebody like Dave Pelz to watch you for several hours, for sure.
Well, and I've always said, you know, with the bunker, you can't be – this is not for the meek and the mild in here. You've got to be strong and get it out of there. And, you know, get that sand and get it up out of there. So – can't be just decelerating and being scared on that shot.
I couldn't agree more. Clint, I'm going to come to you on this one here. Do you think most golfers focus too much on technique and not enough on result? And if so, how do we change that, or should we? I think a lot of golfers focus too much on getting everything just perfect, right? This was a good one, I think, for you. So go ahead.
Oh, absolutely. They think we all do. I mean, it's what we see every day. You know, there's technique this. We can watch YouTube, we can read magazines, and there's a spattering of things about, you know, how to take advantage of it. But, you know, we work a lot with players trying to get them to focus on their weak areas. And, therefore, we want to assure them at some point that their technique is good enough to advance the ball into the scoring area. You know, and, and it takes practice. You got to work on technique, get the fundamentals down. But at some point, you have to believe that your technique and your form is good enough. Stop fretting over it. Stop getting over the ball trying to keep your left elbow close to your side or whatever the newest quirky thing is that you've read or heard on the internet about. Well, you know, I always get a big kick out of it. Hey, 10 minutes to 20 more yards. Come on. I mean, that's trying to teach me this, you know. I don't want to be a, you know. But who, you know, but you're absolutely correct, because that's what we keep getting as a golfing public. That's what we keep getting fed, because so therefore that must be the way to get better at our game is to be better from a fundamental and technique standpoint. But, you know, you can only hit it so good, and you can only hit it so good based on the amount you play. You know, and so the best players in the world just try to maintain good ball striking ability. They don't go out and try to keep changing their technique continually. They become satisfied with the technique and only practice in order to maintain it, not to make it different.
Right.
Okay. And so therefore they focus their attention on being able to play the course in front of them. Now, we play the same golf courses a lot, so you kind of get used to that. But the tour players and the top-line players, they're playing different courses all the time, so they're spending their time getting used to this playing surface this week. They don't show up to try to make their swing better. And I think that the average amateur never gets to a comfort position to think that their ball striking is good enough compared to the amount of time they spend on it. You know, so
right.
If I'm out there practicing every day and working on it, maybe I can tweak my swing a little bit and get it better. But at some point you reach the end of that, and then you have to go to Tim, all this, the mind game and being able to use what you have. You know, I truly believe that most of the people that play golf have hit good shots before. So the question is what's getting in your way? And I think many times the desire to make their technique better is getting in the way of them making good swings already. So we just have to, as a student and as a teacher, we have to prove to our students that their technique is good enough. Now let's begin to learn how to use it, not necessarily improve it.
Yeah, and that really brings up some great points. You're exactly right. I think very early on, again, it doesn't matter what age you are, if you're a beginner golfer, then you need to focus on technique. You need to understand how the swing is coordinated, what all the components, the pieces that go together. But you're right, Clint, there comes a point in time when you kind of max out aspect of it, and now it becomes, okay, how do I put all this together? How do I utilize what I've learned? And I think
right.
The majority of amateurs go out there and they're continually – when something doesn't go right, they automatically assume that all the wheels on the bus have fallen off, and they go back and they try to reinvent that all the time. And you're right. You don't see top-line players, certainly the majority of them. You've seen a few over the years that change up things, Nat, but it's just because they're looking for something specific. But the majority of them don't. Once they get to a certain level, it now becomes other parts of their game that they have to focus on. So that's a great, great point because, again, technique is important to a point, but if you continually are focusing on that, you're never going to score. And all you're going to do is every time you hit a bad shot, you're going to try and tweak and fix and adjust and ultimately end up dissatisfied. And I think that's really why a lot of people that do leave the game is out of frustration of trying to constantly massage that technique when really what they could do is focus on the scoring aspect. They've already got the game. They've already been able – they know they can – as you said, they know they can hit a good golf shot. We're not all going to hit every shot perfect. They already know what to do to get that. So it's now time to focus on how do I put it together to have the best chance at improving my score. That's a great point. I really appreciate that approach to it. All right, Tim, I'm going to come back to you. And this is a little bit – I think really for students, again, what we're going to tackle with the beginning students, what should students be doing before they come back for a lesson, say for lesson two? They've already come to you for a lesson, or Clint or Alicia or myself, and we've sort of set the parameters of what we're going to focus on. Is there something that they should do before they come back to see you again? If so, what is it? And do you have any requirements for them to work on before they do come back?
Yeah, that's a great issue in terms of, and I think as instructors, we've seen probably those of us who have coached for a while, we've seen every type of student and personality style and whatever. But the one thing that I think, and part of it perhaps is a coaching issue, but the other one is a student issue. I generally try and give the students that I work with a single task that they have to get good, a decent task. I shouldn't say good, and good's always a very relative term anyway. But I try to keep it a very simple sequential task that they can accomplish before they come to see me again. Because I know as an instructor, one of the worst things that happens is they don't really do and repeat what we're asking them to do, and they just come back for their weekly lesson or whatever. And it's great as instructors, I guess, for filling the books, but in terms of really helping them, I'm not sure that we do until they acquire a certain skill. Yeah. The other thing is, and I love what you guys were just talking about in terms of the frustration level. And I think that a huge part of the frustration level is because they're not improving at the pace that they think that they should be improving, and so they get frustrated and they either quit the sport or whatever. So, yeah, I do think as instructors we really have to do maybe a little better job of holding them accountable for the task at hand. And I don't see – it's very easy to get distracted or – the other thing is we're talking about, you know, about YouTube clips and everything like that. I can't tell you the number of students over the years, I'll get them focused on something and they'll come back the next week or 2 weeks later. And, yeah, I saw this on YouTube and it says to do this and this and this. And it just is either kind of totally opposite of what you're trying to get them to work on or it's an interesting game, isn't it, in terms of self-analysis. And I guess maybe the point I'm trying to get at is got a saying that I've loved for a long time, feels not real. And so many times what they think they're doing, even in terms of what they've seen or read, or this is what I've read, or this is what YouTube is saying I should do, and A, it may or may not be right. But B, most of the time in my experience, they don't even have the feedback mechanism in place to know if they're actually doing it. And so the whole thing just kind of turns into a not really sure if I'm doing. So that's why as an instructor, I guess the point I'm trying to make is we have to be very specific with what we're trying to get them to do. We have to make sure that they understand what we're trying to get them to do and then just stay on a single task.
Very good. I agree as well. Great point, Tim. Thank you. Alicia, this question I want to ask you, and that is, do you help your students? You know, let me preface this a little bit. You know, all students get into a jam once in a while. They get a little overwhelmed in certain situations. But sometimes some students have learned and seek comfort in a go-to shot. Do you help your students develop a go-to shot in those times when they are feeling a little bit anxious or overwhelmed? Do you help them develop a shot in their bag that they can go to that'll kind of help them power through whatever situation they might be in? And if so, what do you normally advise them?
Yeah, I mean, there's different. I mean, my first thought is there's different go-to shot scenarios, but I was thinking I kind of drifted off into more of a go-to club. With one of my girls last night was telling me their high school coach was you know she there's a par five that I had two kids that were FaceTiming with me and telling me about their round, and one girl took a chance and risked going over this kind of a cooey area with her driver, and the other one took a 7-iron, and she goes, she was explaining to me how she goes, you know me and my hybrid. And she goes, I took a 7-iron, and then I can crush that thing. I can hit that thing anywhere. I can, there's no doubt I can hit that club from anywhere. And my coach came up and said that was the wrong club. She was so mad because she goes, he doesn't understand that I can hit that club anywhere. I mean, I kill it all the time, coach. I'm like, yeah, I understand that. So, you know, he's probably got to get to know your game a little bit, but she has a go-to clubs. And I think there's go-to shots relative to, you know, I'm thinking also a short game with maybe keeping it a little more compact and not doing a full swing, and just those go-to shots that are kind of, you know, throwing darts more into the greens, and just those are a little bit more controlled and not so, you know, out of the full swing menu, if you will. But those are ones that my kids and my students have really appreciated, are those shots that feel like they're not quite full swing. That they really like that. It feels more connected, controlled, and they're just a little more accurate with it. So I would say, you know, I think most people have a go-to club or club, you know, a couple clubs in their bag that they really like, and then that little controlled shot that I would say maybe like a 10-2 shot on the clock, or, you know, those kind of shots are what my students have really appreciated over the last, you know, however many years, 10 years that I've really started focusing on that, you know, that particular method. But anyway.
No, great points. And, you know, I think sometimes even just as something as simple as off the tee, you know, a lot of students that maybe are not comfortable with their driver, sometimes a club, maybe it might be a hybrid or a fairway wood, something that helps them keep it in play is really what I think is very, very helpful for a lot of students. I think a lot of times, you know, students tend to, you know, try to pull off the hero shot thinking, well, maybe if I just do this, and maybe it might not be in their best interest. So sometimes even, you know, a shorter iron, like a 6 or a 7-iron, a mid iron, just keeping it in the fairway. If they're not a very accomplished player, let's just keep it in the fairway. And, you know, as long as you can hit it 150 and 60 yards down the fairway, you can pretty much reach in a few shots most par fours and par fives. So having a go-to shot or even a go-to club, as you suggest, I think is a great way to approach it. Thank you for that, Alicia. Clint, this one, since you brought up putting, I'm going to give to you. How do we handle fast greens? Is there a technique for playing Augusta-like greens?
Well, you know, the joking answer, just keep it below the hole, right? I mean, that's the way you manage a fast green, yeah. Yeah, that's simple, you know. Hate to do that to you. But, no, I think that, yeah, no. Fast greens, slow greens, you manage them all the same way, you know. You know that we've talked many times about benchmark strokes. And, you know, you go to the putting green, and if you're using the benchmark ideas, okay, those benchmark distances are going to change from a slow green to a fast green. And so you have to have some data, some information to work with. So if you're dealing with a green that you're not, you know, maybe not your home course, and it may be a little slower, it may be faster. I think that the question really evolves around abnormal speed, not what you're accustomed to, okay? And so you need to go and get that data and understand that your inside, your back foot putt goes 8 feet today when it usually goes, you know, 4 feet. So you have to take that to the course with you and just try to manage the greens that you're not – generally accustomed to, and, you know, try to – the lag putting on fast greens, as we all know, is much more difficult than lag putting on a medium to slow green, but because you got more rollout. And so you – on your benchmark strokes with the greens are really fast, if I go to a course like that, I want to kind of gauge the rollout. How much is the rollout past my normal distance with my benchmark strokes? Because that's what the fast green is going to give you. It's not necessarily that it's going to be a shorter stroke for the same distances, but the rollout on a fast green is going to be the additional distance that you may not be accustomed to. So really the answer is simple, is that you have to do the same thing on a fast green you do anytime if you're going to go to the benchmark ideas, to understanding how far the ball rolls at certain length of strokes. And you just have to try to manage that as you go around. And, you know, particularly I think if it's really fast greens, that pitch shot from around the green, the player needs to be really focused on not necessarily getting it close to the hole, but focus a little bit more attention on what side of the hole they want to be on. So just the speed, the shot into the green, particularly now we don't want to control the second shot on par fours. We pick it on the green where we can get it. But if you're pitching the ball, start thinking about the side of the hole you want to putt from. And generally speaking, the green will take it to the easiest putt if you let it, because the rollout is going to take it down the fall line. And if it takes it down the fall line, then you should have a relatively, you know, straight putt coming back uphill. So just start thinking about those chips, not necessarily trying to get it really close, but start trying to think about where that fast putt's going to be the easiest. And obviously we'd want to try to get it below the hole on the fall line. So you manage it with the benchmark strokes, but you also manage a little bit different focus in your pitching as well.
I think that was well said. And, here's the thing really is, and I like the way, and that's one of the reasons why I came to you for this particular question, because I know you've answered something similar to this before, as you've alluded
sure.
to. But, I think a lot of people, when it comes to putting, fall into the same trap. They go out and they practice a few short putts, then they do some lag putting, but they don't really, as you put it, sort of put together any sort of stats. So there's really no understanding. And each time they go out, it's different. And without having some sort of, as you said, a benchmark to work from, or a guide, if you will, to work from, it becomes very, very difficult to develop any consistency in your putting game. And so I think going out, if you're going to go out and work on the practice green and you've got a little bit of time, that's what you want to do, is setting up those benchmarks. How far, what do I need to do to get it to roll this amount and this distance and so on and so forth, and then have that as, part of your repertoire, right, when you get out on the green. And a
Just
lot of folks don't do that. Right, exactly. It's information. The more information, and that's what the pros do. The pros have that information. That's why they keep those stats, so they can fall back on that at a later point, because as you said, they're playing so many different courses, they're not playing the same one. So we actually have an advantage for those of us that are maybe playing our home course or a course that we regularly play at. We have an advantage because the conditions typically tend to be the same week in, week out, given a few variances in weather and things like that. Certainly close enough to give us a general idea. So we have an advantage. So doing that is definitely a good thing. All right, I'm going to come back to Tim. And, again, I'm going to ask each of you a question. If we have time, I've got one that I'd like all of you to answer. But this one, Tim, I want you to – we're playing for a club event. How do we prepare physically, mentally, and emotionally for that event, Tim?
Yeah, really, really good question, because I think the important thing is that what I find as a coach is that I think sometimes that players don't break it down into each of the three areas. I look at mental really as strategy, and it's really thought-based and decision-based, and, do I want to hit the 6-iron or the 7-iron? Where's the wind coming from? What's the lie of my ball? Things like that, but really more decision-based. And then physical, of course, well, what am I bringing to the course today? How do I feel? How does my body feel? What kind of shots am I warming up with? Maybe what are my tendencies today and things like that? And then emotional, of course, and I still maintain that emotion is probably the driving force for the other two, the mood that I'm in and my attitude and, do I really think I can get the job done? But as a coach, I really like to see each of those components. When we talk about it, what can we bring to the course? Yeah, I think that's important that we do all that. But maybe particularly that we really begin to develop routines in terms of a pre-shot routine where we go through each of those three components. You know, what kind of shot do I want to hit? And say I want to hit a cut shot or whatever. Then this is how that swing would feel. And too many times what I see are amateurs without any sort of a pre-shot routine. So they sit and imagine maybe what they want to have happen to the ball. But kinesthetically, from a feel standpoint, they don't really have a clue of how their body, of how they want it to move and how they want the club face to feel and things like that. So the brain goes scanning, of course, for information that it doesn't have current access to. And I do see a lot of errors that come from that. And then again, emotionally, I think that maybe setting the tone, well, I know setting the tone before a shot, but also before we get to the course, I don't think enough amateurs really set the tone for how they want to, the attitude they want to bring to the game today and the mood that they're going to be in. And that's when it only takes a shot or two for them to be totally off in the weeds and, you know, a bad hole and they're pretty much done for the day. And that, of course, is, you know, we instructors know is probably one of the biggest differences between the rank amateur and, say, a touring professional is, touring professionals tend to, although not all the time, but tend to get over the mistakes pretty quickly, whereas amateurs, it can be a downward spiral pretty quickly. And so, what we bring to, you know, again, we could say what we bring to the course, but I would dare say it needs to be more specific than that in terms of what we bring to each shot. And then, are we really present to the experience? Are we playing it a shot at a time? Is our mind off in the past or the future or all that kind of stuff? So the ability to just stay focused in the present moment, I think, is the best shot anybody's got at playing good golf.
I, again, couldn't agree more wholeheartedly, Tim. Great points. Alicia, this is a question I have, and Tim sort of got into it a little bit, but maybe you can talk about some different aspects of it. But everybody goes out, and whether you're a junior particularly or maybe a collegiate player, we'll deal with that end of the spectrum just to make it a little bit more defined. They anticipate that they're going to lose from time to time. Probably more so than they're going to win, obviously. Dealing with that loss, especially for juniors and even collegiate players, can be very difficult. Maybe even to add more insult to injury, if they've been leading the tournament and then something happens and they lose that. Some players, Greg Norman comes to mind on a professional level, who's had that happen to him in majors a number of times over his career. Some say he didn't recover when he lost to Nick Faldo back in, I believe it was 89 in the Masters. So what do we do? How do you handle that with a student? We'll deal again with junior golfers and or collegiate golfers. When they've come back from an event, they're coming to see you and they're down because they haven't been able to get over that event. What do you do? What's the conversation you're going to have with them? And where do you start off? Do we just sort of pick up on whatever lesson was next, or what do we do?
So several things come to mind when you're asking that question. So the first thing is, like, I'll ask them what was good and what could be better. So I'm trying to focus on the, you know, what could be better is asking you, like, okay, where do you need some work and what where's our focus maybe need to be, like, turned to. But and you can start asking that, you know, and just start writing down some things that maybe some mistakes they made, or if they made course management mistakes on the course, that sort of thing. But maybe they had a mental lapse and there's all those learnings in there, like what take me through the round. I also, you know, would encourage them to evaluate when they're done with the round, which is what we, you know, when I ask them that question, that's what we're essentially doing. And what did they learn about themselves when they're out there? Like, if they can look at themselves objectively now and say, yeah, I really, you know, what you've taught me about how to stay, you know, clear-minded and let go of things, I didn't do that so well, or I really did, you know, that really well. And so I've taught my kids adversity statements, and some of them are personal. And then we had one that was in a book that I did a winter program. And I actually just received a letter 2 days ago from one of my students that said, you know, you've taught me that life and golf, there's a lot of adversity and there's a lot of things that aren't going to go my way. But because of that mm-hmm. statement that you made us all memorize, and it's the sentence is, I am a champion and I have a deep and unwavering belief in myself and my ability to perform well. She literally said, I say that with anything now in my life, that I am a champion and I can do this. I've got this. So I always try to find, even though they lose, I think, or they might have lost that particular match or whatever, I want to find what they learned in that particular situation.
Mm-hmm.
Because honestly, when I played at a high level of basketball, and we won 57 games in a row, and we got to the last season of my senior year, and we lost this really important game to advance to the state tournament, and I wished we would have lost the game that was really close, like two-thirds of the way through that season, so there wasn't so much pressure. I wish we would have lost to learn, like, what did we learn in that? And so I always focus and tell my kids, I think it's a really good thing when you maybe don't get the end result that you want, but you got to focus on and have that to be a motivation to move forward and, you know, work harder and just, you know, where do you need to work at it? Is it your mental game? Is it your physical, you know, whatever it is, but it's all, you know, the pie is a lot of parts, but I always try to focus on what was good and what could be better and saying it's okay to have both of those scenarios. You're going to win some and you're going to lose some. So you have to learn, you have to feel both of them. You've got to experience both of them.
Yeah. And that's some great points as well, Alicia, because again, a lot of times the sort of go-to position for a lot of players, especially less skilled players, is there must be something wrong with my game. You know, and it could be something entirely different. It may not that they weren't hitting the best shots. There may be other factors that could have been involved. And a lot of times what we find is then they start, you know, as we talked about earlier, sort of start tweaking and monkeying around with the swing and end up making things worse. You know, we're all going to be faced with adversities. And I think that's a great mantra, if you will, that you have them sort of memorize. Because, you know, again, if you're filling your mind with negative thoughts, again, we're all going to have losses in life, not just on the golf course. And if you're not really assessing what the problem is, and you're just sort of guessing at it and making changes in areas that may not have anything to do with the reason you didn't win that match, then you ultimately end up making it, compounding it and making it much worse. So great points on that. And that's a great way, I think, to handle, you know, that sort of diversity with a student. Clint, we're going to go to this one here. And as I said, if we have time, there's a question I'm going to throw to all three of you and see if we can put this one together. But this one's here, I think, again, for students. And again, obviously, it depends on the level. But, you know, if you were coaching a student and they posed this question, how do I know when to go for it and or when to play it safe and be more conservative? A lot of people go out there and you get some, you know, steady eddies that go out there and just play it safe all the time, and that's fine, but they never really take any chances. Then you get others that are going for everything. How do we know as a player? How do you help the player understand how to use their noggin, if you will, and making a decision when it's appropriate to maybe go for it, or maybe when it's just, hey, let's just play this one safe. What's the conversation there?
Well, I mean, when you get into those conversations, I think you're talking about a well above average player. Those are not questions mm-hmm. that you get from the hunter shooter. Those are the questions you get from that, you know, the kid or collegiate player or good amateur player, you know, and this obviously comes down to decision making and what you feel comfortable with. And when I was coaching collegiately, I would go around the course that we were playing in a tournament and say, okay, what is on a given hole, is par a good score here? You know, mm-hmm. tough hole, you got some maybe hazard to the left or the right, is par a good score on this hole? Well, those are the holes where you don't play the hero shot, because par is a good score. There's going to be, if you're going to win this tournament, there's going to be more bogeys made here than birdies on this hole. So this is where can I make a par from? No hero shots. Then on the holes that you're going out there, so, okay, well, it's kind of open. I can, you know, par is not a good score on this hole. That's when I need to take dead aim. I need to give myself a good chance of making birdie. But like I always told my kids when we're playing, you know, we shoot 288 every round, we win. You know, I mean, that's even par. And so where can I make par? So then you start breaking that decision down to both what the individual does as far as their ball flight is concerned. You get a hole where you can take it at it. If I'm a right-to-lefter, I may have a hole that I'm going to go for it, but the player that plays from left to right may not. So it gets down to a real individual thing. I don't think there's a blanket thing you can say about when to go for it or not. I think it comes down to real individual, what the ball flight is, the particular type of hole, and making some decisions on whether par is a really good score here. And the tour players do that. You hear them, hey, I make a par. That's a great score on this hole. Let's go to the next one.
Right.
You know, they're going to hit in the middle of green, two putt, and go to the next opportunity because the risk and reward on that is too high. It's just too high. So you have to determine if you're playing a home course, you know, if you're out playing a practice round for a tournament, you really need to start evaluating what you think the field is going to do on this hole and play it accordingly based on your game. But figure out which ones are good pars, and those are the ones you play safe. You play the middle of green, take your par. Maybe you make a 25, 30-footer, but you take your par, go to the next real good opportunity. And that comes down from individual players and individual courses, but it really comes down to a hole-by-hole decision. Develop your strategy that you're going to play and then stick to it. I see a lot of kids I coach that we go through that, and before you know it, hey, you know, they're not playing that safe hole safe. They got it aimed right dead at it. You know, they're not staying with their plan. The best scorers stay with the plan, and they develop. You know that old thing about, you know, plan your work and work your plan. And when it comes down to where you're going to go for it or not, I think those decisions are made before you tee it up on the first hole.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's another great point. Again, obviously, it's going to vary from player to player. That's a given,
right.
I think. And I think that this is where you really have to understand your game and what your abilities are. If you know that you're a competent ball striker and you can hit the ball well, you might be willing to take a little bit more risk. And if you're not, if you're very shaky, you know, off the tee or even from the middle of the fairway, if you're not confident in your approach shots, then you don't necessarily need to be going for it, especially if you're going over water and trying to go for a tight pin. So, and you know, Nicklaus famously said that as well. You know, a lot of times he would get up on a course where he might have a hole or two that didn't fit his eye. And he said the same thing. Mm-hmm. If I can get away with the par here, then I'm happy. And if a birdie happens to come my way, that's even better. But again, it was more strategy for him than actual his ball striking ability. All right, so this one here, I'm going to try and see if we can sneak in the last few minutes. Tim, we're going to start with you, and this is one I don't want you to answer all of them, but maybe just add one or so, maybe two at the most, and we'll have to go fairly quickly here so we can get everybody in. But maybe a few tips, or I said here five, but there might be more, it might be a little bit less. Tips to help navigate any round. So if you've got a student that's maybe getting ready to play an event coming up, what's maybe a tip that you're going to give them to help them navigate around the course?
Yeah. I got to say the best tip that I would have is, and we talk about it a lot, is one shot at a time. And I don't think that can be emphasized enough. I am a firm believer that all negative emotion out there, all the doubt we feel and the indecision we feel and the lack of belief we feel always surrounds a mind that's gone into the past or into the future. And so if we can just keep a player really one shot at a time, and maybe more importantly, something they believe that they can achieve in that moment with that shot, that to me would be the key to just not getting what we tend to do as players is we drag up the past, something that didn't work. We forget about
right.
the now
right.
and project it right into the future. Oh, this could happen again. And before
right.
long, we've just got a mind that is all over the place. So, yeah, one shot at a time. I'm very fond of saying take care of the shot and it all works out. And even when I deal with work with a lot of college players, how do I get a college scholarship, you know? And they're so far off in the future. And I tell them, you take care of each shot one at a time, and the coaches will find you. But you got to take care of the shot. Mm-hmm. You can't be thinking about – and it's true of tour school too, right? The professionals,
yep.
the mini-tour players, their mind is so far off in the tour that they forget to take care of the shots. Just take care of the shot one at a time. That's the best advice I've got.
Yep, I think that's a great one. Yeah, too many of them are thinking about winning the Masters, and they haven't even gotten their tour card yet. So, yeah, I think that's a good one to start with.
Bingo.
Alicia, what about you? Is there a tip that you might have that you would give your students if they were getting ready to maybe play in an upcoming event? It could be a club championship, or it might be a mini tour event, or whatever the case may be, or maybe just even with their friends on the weekend, they haven't played maybe in a week or two, and they want to get out there. What would the tip be that you would like to start them off on the right path with?
Yeah, I certainly concur with what was said before about the one shot at a time. That's always, you know, very great advice for any golfer. And then, you know, I think one of the things that comes to mind is I talk about A-B golf, and really, you know, ball is always A, and B is where you, you know, the prime place where you want to put it. And I try to give them like a little fun thing to say, okay, you know, whatever, wherever, if you stood on at a specific point on the golf course and you could pick your ball up and just walk it out there and say, I want to be right there. That's B. That's so I'm going to hit my ball at A and I want to go to B. But in that, I want to make sure that I get what I call a triple W line, meaning I'm going to win and win and win. So, I mean, there's always risk and reward, obviously, with golf, but for the masses, I think the most part I wanted to try to emphasize, if I hit it straight, I win and I'm in play. If I hit it a little left, I'm okay, I'm in play. And if I hit a little right, I'm okay and I'm in play. So I always try to get them to strategize a little bit about where do you want to be, you know, if you pick that ball up, where do you want it to be? And then also find your triple W line. So those are the two things that, you know, just and then also what was mentioned before about, you know, the one shot at a time.
I think that's a great tip as well. Clint, what about you? What's a tip that you might have? Again, somebody might be playing in an upcoming event and you want to get them started off right to enjoy their round. What would you suggest to them to help navigate?
Well, I think what's been said is wonderful. The question I would have is, how do I accomplish that? Okay. And what I try to get my students to understand is we want to be one shot at a time. We want to take the good line. But how I'm going to be able to accomplish that is really by controlling my tension level. Try to stay relaxed. Don't let it increase. And control your breathing. I mean, as long as I'm breathing calmly, my heart rate is going to go down. If I start holding my breath or breathing short, you know, it's fight or flight. My tension is going to go up and whatever. So when I'm out playing, I know I try to start each swing by, all right, am I breathing properly? You know, and you can watch the videos of the PGA Championship and watch Mickelson behind the ball and pay attention to what he's doing. He's standing there getting his heart rate down, bringing his tension level down to where he can stay in the moment and hit the shot that we all want to hit. So everything that was said is wonderful, but the way we accomplish that is maintaining consistent low levels of tension in your body and keep breathing, and then we can accomplish those things. So don't, you know, pay attention to your breathing through the round, pay close attention to the grip pressure you have and your shoulder tension, and then you'll be able to stay in the moment and hit the shot that you're capable of hitting.
Very interesting tip as well. I think I would add to that, and I think it sort of falls in a little bit of line of what you're talking about, Clint, is I would probably say to my student is, play to your rhythm. In other words, find what your rhythm or cadence is in your game. And the reason why I say that is quite often we see players, obviously not at the professional level, but we see players, amateurs, that get in with a group. Some groups might play more like a Nick Price. They're very quick in their rhythm, very quick in their pace. some players tend to try to rise up to that level of, and it may not be, they may be more like an Ernie Els or a Freddie Couples in their cadence. So I like to find their rhythm. And again, as you suggest, Clint, I think controlling your breathing, being in a relaxed mode is going to help them do that. But you never want to play outside of your rhythm. So whatever your natural body rhythm is, that's how you want to play. Because when you change that, doesn't matter what sport you're playing or what you're doing in life, if you're a slow walker, then that's obviously going to be connected with your rhythm. You don't all of a sudden start walking fast or running fast if that's not in your rhythm. So I think once you establish what your rhythm for the day is going to be and you stick with that, you're going to find that you're going to be in much more control of what your body does throughout the day. If you start changing that rhythm, like you said, if you start breathing a little faster or a little different, then that's going to change a lot of that. So that's what I would probably say is find your rhythm. And one way to do that, to develop that consistency, I've always found, and we've talked about this many, many times on the show, is developing that pre-shot routine, because that will help you keep a pace. If you develop a consistent pre-shot routine that you're going to use before every single shot, and you do not vary it any way, shape, or form, you're going to keep within that rhythm. If you 1 minute you stand up and you take two looks and whack the ball, and the next time you're standing back and you're throwing grass up and you're doing something entirely different, a lot of times you'll fall out of that rhythm. And so that's what I always try to do with students that I've worked with, is to get them to find their natural body rhythm. And you'd be surprised how many don't know it. So those are some things. I think those are some great tips if we want to help our golfers to get out and navigate any round. And I think you guys, as always, have done a great job. So I appreciate your answers tonight, guys. And as I always do, I'm going to give each of you a moment or two to let the folks know if they want to reach out or get in touch in some way, the best way that they can do that. So we'll do in the order that we started. Tim, you go first, and then Alicia, and then Clint.
Yeah, they can reach me at peakperformancemindcoaching.com, and would love to hear from folks. And certainly we offer some mind game tips, and I do clinics throughout the country, starting to get a little bit back into that now that COVID is easing up, although I'm not sure that we're not into another little dip in it. But in any case, that's where they can find me.
Perfect. And Alicia, what about you?
You could contact me at gratitudegolf.com, and there's an email place where you can contact me through that. And otherwise, I'm in Pensacola. That's the first time I said that one, huh? And at Marcus Point Golf Club. So if they want to come down to Pensacola at Marcus Point, I believe that I'm the only female teacher in the entire area. So hey, that's we can just Google that, I guess, maybe. I don't know. Anyway. It's all good. Yeah. I'm excited to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you down, and welcome to the South officially. Clint, what about yourself? How can we get in touch with you?
Well, they can always get it at clintgoff001@yahoo.com. That's my email. Or they can private message or take a look at Third Shot Golf on Facebook. That's the easiest way to get a hold of me. And to help my guys here tonight, everybody needs to go to Pensacola. It's a wonderful place. And get on Tim's website and log on and get the thought of the day. I've been getting it for a while now, and there's some really good thoughts of the day, Tim. I really look forward to those every morning when I get up.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. I guess I did forget to mention that. Thank you.
I really do. And I appreciate, Ted, you include me all the time like you do, and we've had a great time. Thanks.
Always is.
Well, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm glad to have all of you on the show. I appreciate it and all that you bring. That's what makes it fun every Thursday evening for me. So thank you, guys. Have a great weekend, and I'll see you next time on the Coach's Corner panel here on Golf Talk Live. Have a great weekend, guys. Thank you.
Thanks again.
Good night, everybody. Bye. Bye.
All right. That was Tim Kramer, Alicia Larson, and Clint Wright joining me this evening on the Coach's Corner panel. We're going to take a quick break, and then we will welcome my very special guest, world-renowned golf landscape painter and artist, Linda Harto. She'll be joining me here in just a moment after these brief messages.
This edition of Golf Talk Live is brought to you by Golf Pal, the best place to find only the finest in golf training aids and accessories. Get in on some great deals on leading products such as Down Under Board, Rapsodo, Golf Slingshot, and more. Visit golfpal.golf today. And don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter. Golf Pal. We're serious about your game.
The following ad is sponsored by Golf Tips Magazine.
Are you tired of being short off the tee? And what about those three putts? Forget about it. It's time you got serious about your game. Golf Tips, the most in-depth magazine in the industry. For over 30 years, Golf Tips has delivered expert content such as the latest golf instruction from America's top pros, simple to follow practice and game improvement drills, fitness and mental game tips, equipment, training aids, accessory and apparel reviews, golf destinations and travel tips for every budget, and so much more. Don't miss a single issue. Go to golftipsmag.com and subscribe today.
All right. Once again, thank you everybody for joining me this evening. I'm very excited to welcome back my special guest, Linda Harto. I'm going to tell you a little bit about her, just for those of you that maybe weren't tuned in the last time she was on. I'll just tell you a little bit about her, and then I will bring her on, and we'll begin our interview portion of the show. Linda is a world-renowned golf landscape artist. Her work is displayed in the permanent collections of such legendary clubs as Augusta National, Laurel Valley, Pinehurst, and Pine Valley, in the personal collections of such golf notables as Jack Nicklaus, Ray Floyd, and Reese Jones, and in the collections of the USGA Museum in Far Hills, New Jersey, and in the Morris Museum of Art in Augusta, Georgia. Her paintings of various holes at Augusta National Golf Club are prized by collectors the world over. In addition, Linda painted the first of the U.S. Open Series in 1990, commissioned by the USGA, a 25-year series she completed in 2014, as well as her British Open Championship Series from 1990 to 99. In 2017, Linda was an inductee into the Lowcountry Golf Hall of Fame and has been honored with the Golf Digest Lifetime Achievement Award. So please welcome my very special guest again this evening, Linda Harto.
Hi.
Good evening, Linda, and welcome back.
Very nice.
How are you
to be
doing?
Here. I'm doing just great. Thank you. That was a wonderful introduction. Thank you.
Well, I went from memory. No, I didn't. I had my little cheat sheet here. You had so many accolades. It was hard so I had to write them all down, of course. But welcome back, Linda. I really appreciate you coming back.
And thank you.
I thought what we would do. You're very welcome. My pleasure. I thought what we would do is maybe go back a little bit before we get into the main part of our discussion, and maybe you could just talk about how you got to do what you do, because you know it's not just like you woke up one day and said, "Well, I'm gonna paint golf landscapes, or I'm gonna paint famous golf holes." There was a process. So walk us back a little, go back in time a little bit, and walk us through that process, how you got to where you are today.
Okay. Well, I've always been an artist as long as I can remember. So. Art has always been the first thing in my life, and I painted a lot of different subjects and have always made my living from my art. So I learned, kind of to be able to do commission work. And in 1984, I was asked if I could paint a golf course. And I said, sure. And it happened to be Augusta National. So that's how I got started with golf art. The pros there, which was Dave Spencer and Bob Kletke at the time, they were looking for an artist to paint and make some prints so they could sell them at the Masters. And my first one was the 13th hole. And they took the painting and had it printed at the local commercial printer, a friend of theirs, which I had never printed my work before. So it was all new experience for me, for sure. But anyhow, that's how it got started. And then I worked, I did several paintings for them, and well, it was 85, 86, 87, and 88. And by then, other clubs were calling me. So I thought, wow, there must be something to this. Yeah. Of course, at the time, I didn't realize, you know, that I actually, had I started with any other club, probably it would have been one and done. But
right.
Since it was Augusta, it was like instant introduction into the golf world. So, and they really appreciated my art. So I thought, well, you know, this is maybe a good thing here.
Well, and what's interesting about it is, I mean, you've done a lot of famous holes and mm-hmm. a lot of golf courses over the years, mm-hmm. since then. But you're right. I think starting with something like Augusta National sort of really got you going right out of the gate. And
right.
I think you're right. I think if you had have gone, to the local Muni down the street, not that the
right.
artwork wouldn't have spoken volumes, but again, it probably wouldn't have resonated quite as much within the golfing industry. But you very quickly became, world-renowned. I mean, you literally, mm-hmm. From a very early point, developed a lot of recognition to the point where others, U.S. Open venues as well, started reaching out and saying, hey, we would like you to do, X, Y, Z. So it
right.
was like a snowball effect.
Yeah, it really was.
Really
But I think the real turning point was when I just started investigating the golf world as a business and went to the 1988 PGA show. And that was a real eye-opener. I realized mm-hmm. that there was nothing out there. There was no art. There was no anything, worthy, I thought. And I thought, wow, this is wide open. And through that very show, I got connected with a gentleman in Scotland who was a golf antiques dealer. So we kind of went into business together starting then, and he was responsible for helping me get my commission with the R&A for the Open Championship, and then as soon as that was secure, he went right over and talked to the USGA, and we started that. So we started both those series in 1990. And at the same time, I was determined to bring the print quality to fine art as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go and find printers and literally learn the entire process of printing and publishing by myself. But I did. I was determined, to have state-of-the-art every part, not just the painting, but the prints as well.
Right, exactly. And that's no easy task to be able to do that. It took a lot of work. I want to talk about for a little bit, again, mm-hmm. so people can really appreciate what it is that you do. Talk about the actual process. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I was surprised. I mean, I knew that it would take, even the best of the best a while to actually complete a painting, but there's
mm-hmm.
a lot of prep work that goes into it as well. So maybe you can kind of walk us through a little bit of that. When you first either get, approached to do a specific hole or
mm-hmm.
part of a course or something along that idea, where does it begin?
Well, it begins really with an agreement, of course. But then I go to the actual course, and it's a process of kind of listening to people at the course, the pros and the people that play there, what is their most memorable holes? What do they think of when they think of that course? And then I like to see the whole course and kind of get a feeling for its character. And then I kind of zero in on the particular holes that I think would make a good representation. And then once we agree on that, or there may be several holes, then I have to photograph those holes in the right light, which is always tricky.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's the part that really, as a fine artist, that's the part that interests me the most, is how is that hole lit? How does it look? And I have to find that perfect lighting, which really shows off everything I want you to be able to see. So that can take a while. You know, it can take a week, it can take weeks, it can take more than one trip to the course. You know, every time I went to Scotland, I'd go to St. Andrews. It would be different every single time I went. And even Augusta.
Right.
As many years as I went there to photograph, it was always different in some way. So you're just always looking for that particular scene that maybe you've never seen before. That particular lighting, angle, whatever. Yeah.
Do you ever find that, or have you ever found when you've gone somewhere, I mean, obviously you're, again, when you're talking about Augusta National and, you know, over in Scotland, some of the open championship courses that they play on, Carnoustie and and so forth, St. Andrews, were there ever moments you got over there and whether it be the lighting or what have you just was not right and you just didn't feel like you were capturing the image? I figured that would be something that would happen. So what do you do in a case like that? You know, you can't, you know, obviously I know you're not just going over for one day if you're going to Scotland, but if you have to go out to a course over several days, does there come a point you say, well, I guess I'm going to have to accept this, or you just say, no, I'm going to have to, you know, keep trying? What do you do at that point?
Have to go another time, maybe another season even. Different lighting. It's just like at St. Andrews, if you go in the summertime, which, you know, high summer, it's not as interesting as it is in late, like August, September, and October even. It's the angle of the sun on the significant holes makes a huge difference. And even the kind of light, you know, the kind of light in September and October, I find much more beautiful than in high summer.
Mm-hmm.
And if they've had a dry year, sometimes I didn't even go to Scotland. I could tell just by watching the tournaments that this was not going to be a good year. You know how they can be when
because
it's dry,
right.
You know, this just like wispy, rough, and not interesting to me. You know, I like to see them at their optimum.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was just about to say. You want to see them, figuratively speaking, in their best light. Otherwise, it's you're not going to be able to capture the essence of the whole. So now that you've gotten the images that you need, and again, that could happen over several weeks or days or what have you, depending on the circumstances.
Or years.
or even years. Now what happens? What's the next step? Once you look at the photos and you say, okay, these are going to work for me, then what's next in the process?
Well, what's next? Of course, while I'm there, I take hundreds of photographs, and I take overall shots and also detail shots. So if I have a scene, I will take the 300-millimeter shots of every piece of that scene. So there's like, you know, 20, 30 shots, just one picture, one scene. And that way when I'm working area, I have a detail that is just like being there, basically. When I have all those gazillion pictures and I'm home in the studio, I kind of lay them all out, or now I work on the computer looking at all these millions of pictures. And I just look for all the elements that are the best and finally decide on what it's going to look like. And that process could take quite a while because I like to literally visualize the painting complete before I ever start. So that could take a while.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. If you're being commissioned, let's say, to do something, whether it be Augusta or any of the courses that you're doing,
mm-hmm.
and you've taken all these photos, do you then go back to them, whoever you're dealing with, and show them what you like, and do they sort of mm-hmm. have involvement in what they want you to do at that point? I mean, obviously, there may be certain holes that they're looking at, or do they basically mm-hmm. rely on your judgment to pick whatever image you're going to transfer
yeah,
to the canvas,
they,
so to speak?
They were pretty good about listening to my take on it, and in knowing what it's going to be used for is significant, too. I mean, mm-hmm. if it's the prints are to be sold at a tournament, or if, you know, it's for a club, a private club, it's ultimately all those go into the decision-making on which image it is. But it's usually mutually agreed upon pretty much before I even leave the property. Or
right.
it's left up, you know, in terms of the U.S. Open, it was usually just left up to me. And the same way with the Open Championship, it's just whatever I thought.
Right. Well, sure. It's obviously your vision. I mean, they have certain things that they
mm-hmm.
want, but obviously they're leaving it up to your expertise because you're the one that's going to be essentially commissioning it.
But
I mentioned
also,
earlier, too.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, also, you know, I have, how shall we put it, over all the years of marketing my own work and selling it personally, I developed a sense of knowing what the market wants and what will be successful
right.
and what won't. So a lot of times I have to convince, well, not a lot of times, but sometimes I have to convince the person or the people that the scene I've chosen is in their best interest.
Right.
You know.
So. That's where a little arm twisting sometimes comes in, I guess.
Well, sometimes, because like USGA, they'll think of a hole completely differently than I do. They'll think of it, oh, well, this one has the most strategic advantages and the
right.
most history and this and that and this and that. But then as a painting, it would look like hell. So I have to convince them that, you know, this is not going to be a good image and people won't buy it. It's
right.
like, you know, the first time I did, well, I was commissioned to do the 17th hole at Pebble Beach, right? Well, they wanted me
mm-hmm.
to do it from the tee. And I'm like, really?
Yeah.
You know what the 17th hole looks like from the tee? It's like this little
mm-hmm.
teeny strip. Golf and the rest is sky and grass. And I
right.
said, no, I'm not doing that. And they let me do it the way I wanted, and it's been one of the best-selling prints I've ever had.
Well, and see, and this is where, you know, the artist's eye sort of comes into it. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, as you said, for them, it's, you know, it's about the nostalgia and, you know, this hole was featured in whatever the case may be,
right.
and or has had this level of history, but it
mm-hmm.
may not actually be the best representation of even the course.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of things to go into it. Now, I mentioned earlier, and I wanted to ask you, and again, you don't have to give specific examples on each of them, but just maybe a general overview. I mentioned that
mm-hmm.
you've worked on or contributed to some of the personal collections of some notables, Jack Nicklaus, Reese Jones, and Raymond Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
What particularly were they looking for? Was it just specific, were there specific holes, or were they just sort of wanting to sort of recapture moments in their you know, history? What was some of the requests?
It was basically their let's see, how do we put it? Significant, well, for and as Jack Nicklaus, for instance, his significant wins.
Right.
He has seven paintings, and they were all his major wins and his favorite holes, mm-hmm. pretty much. And Ray Floyd with Augusta, and then Rees Jones. These were courses he designed. So,
right.
You know, it was like a special, and even his father bought one of Hazeltine. That was one of his favorites. So there's all kinds of reasons.
So it was, Right. So it was more or less a walk down memory lane for them, as they wanted a record in whether it be a painting or even in print of some memorable moments throughout their history, either as a course designer or as a player who had a number of events that were successful for them. So obviously that would make sense. So it's very interesting that just what everybody's viewpoint. Now I mentioned too also that you were inducted into the Lowcountry Golf Hall of Fame and also honored by Golf Digest with the Lifetime Achievement Award. Those obviously had to be very special for you, correct?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
What did that mean when you got the call? Yeah, go ahead.
Because, for one thing, I've always felt like, even though I was in the golf world, I was not really in it. You know, the art is not exactly accepted as a major part of the game, even though it is. So...
Right.
As a kind of an outsider working in the golf world, it meant a huge thing. You know, it was huge to be recognized. And then also being a female and, well, at least when I started, what amounted to be a very male world, that was quite an achievement to negotiate that, you know, especially in the early days. It's like,
well, and
you know. I went to Pine Valley. I was actually in Pine Valley. How many women could have said that in 1990, you know?
Well, and you said, and I believe in 1988, you went to the PGA Merchandising Show and found that there really wasn't a lot in your area of expertise representing the golf industry. And really, in this that day and age, I mean, that's, 20-something years ago, 30 some odd years ago, that's surprising with as much history and nostalgia that goes with golf to begin with, that's, you know, there really wasn't a lot of representation there. So you've obviously done a lot. Right.
You know, it did as a fine artist, you know, from, training and my whole life orientation was towards fine art, to go and see an area, a genre that wasn't well represented at all with fine art, except for the antiquities. Now, there's plenty of fine art in the antiquities, but not current. And then what little art there was out there was so poorly printed and presented and cheap. You know, it was just like astounding to me that nobody had done anything with that. So I decided
I think so. You could call yourself really somewhat of a pioneer then in golf to really, you know. Well, I know you are.
I didn't know how much
saying.
Of one when I started. No. I just saw the potential.
Well.
I didn't know how hard it was going to be, but.
Well, you've fared very well over the years, obviously.
Definitely.
And opened up a door. Yeah, you've opened up a door to an area of golf that, you know, really we had not seen up until that point.
Right.
In 2003, you were one of the founding trustees of the Academy of Golf Art.
Right.
Tell us a little about that. Why was that? What was your thought process in mm-hmm. developing that? What was it you wanted to achieve?
Again, it was to bring to the art world recognition of a genre that wasn't being recognized.
Right.
I thought by forming the Academy and trying to have shows and connect collectors with artists and then providing a place for really good artists who may like to do golf art, providing them a place to do it and show it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not necessarily someone that did nothing but golf art, but recognized fine artists. There's plenty of them that like the game of golf, you know, and they'd probably really like to do it. So that was the idea. And we formed
and
it then, and we've had some shows, but, you know, we've had economic problems with different
sure
economy problems, a few here and there.
Right.
That would set us back, and then we'd get going again, and we're about, you know, dealing with that again, and hopefully we'll get through it again. So, but it's a process.
And you have a number of artists now that participate, that provide mm-hmm. content, if you will,
mm-hmm.
to the Academy of Golf Art. So it obviously has grown. It, like any organization, it has its ups and downs, and, you know, fiscal economies obviously affect that. But overall, it's gained some momentum over the last 30 or so years since you really pioneered a lot, and people have taken an interest in not only what you do, but what some of the others do as well, correct?
Right, yes, and I think it's going to go to a different level here soon, too. So, yes, it's very exciting.
Very good. Now, I know that you also, I had a few weeks ago, I had Dr. Bernecki
mm-hmm.
from the Golf Heritage Society, who was on, and I know you know him very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand you're going to be participating in a golf art symposium October 1st of this year in Monroeville, Pennsylvania. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. The Golf Historical Society is having their 50th year anniversary meeting, which is quite significant. And we just kind of our two organizations, the Academy of Golf Art, and we're kind of, you know, aligned a lot. So we decided to mm-hmm. combine forces, and we'd have a special exhibition, and also they put together this art symposium, which was really great. So, I think the collectors, it's good for the collectors to have that kind of information and be introduced to the future antiquities, not just past ones, before we croak.
Right.
You know, they should be collecting us now, not later.
Right. I couldn't agree more. I think it's very good, as I mentioned when Dr. Byrne was on the show. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, he obviously approaches things from a different area of golf. Again, he's looking at the heritage, if you will, of the game,
mm-hmm.
and he's looking to pass that heritage on to future generations. I mean, he shared a number of stories
absolutely.
When he was here about what they're trying to do to a younger generation
mm-hmm.
to make them aware. And actually, what was quite interesting was how engaging, which is very surprising, especially this day and age, how engaging some of these youngsters were in wanting to learn more. So when you look at the future of what you do in golf landscapes, where do you see, or what would you like to see happen moving forward?
We have a plan. And part of that, of course, is to incorporate working with young people and having, I don't know, maybe contests or just somehow getting involved with maybe first tee groups or, you know, just sponsoring classes for young people that might be interested in golf art too. So there's all kinds of opportunity there. It's just that we just haven't got there yet. But it's in the plan.
Well, it's like everything. It's all, yeah, it's always a work in progress. I mean, it's always, mm-hmm. you have to, you know, do one step at a time. Now, you
yeah.
also have a website, and we'll talk mm-hmm. about that for a few moments, hartogh.com, and it's spelled HARTOUGH.com is your website. And
yes.
People can actually look at a lot of the work that you've done. Now, obviously, you do paintings, but you also have them then turning into prints as well, which you obviously sell.
Right.
So mm-hmm. are there things that you're working on right now? Are there some new projects that you're working on now that you want to share with us?
Well, I've been working with private clubs recently. I haven't been doing too many of the championships, tournament work. I kind of ended those series, but I just finished one for Glenview in Chicago. They had the Western Open here just a couple of weeks ago. And mm-hmm. there's a few more private clubs in the future here. I forgot where I was going with that. as far as the website, we have we've been doing these Guess the Winner contests where, you know, a major tournament like next week, we'll have a Guess the Winner contest for the Tour Championship, and we give away a free print to people that guess the winner. So that's kind of fun, and it engages everyone. I think they really enjoy it, so that's something we like to do and keep that up. We'll have a Ryder Cup contest too, and, you know, that's kind of fun.
And
but we
for those
also,
that want to, obviously, go ahead. Please go ahead.
We also specialize in custom things. If somebody wants something in particular size, canvas, paper, or maybe texturized. We kind of specialize in doing and fitting, specific projects for either offices or homes or whatever. So you actually talk to a person when you order.
Yeah, that makes a big difference. I know I'm probably much like you. I'm not really fond of the automated systems that we
offer. I mean, you can order on the website like any other website, but the girl that works for me, Sharon, she's like, whatever we can do to accommodate, you know, we figure out framing mm-hmm. for them and everything. So we just do whatever, and that's kind of
give them
our specialty right now is customer service.
Exactly, giving them a more customized
mm-hmm.
approach to customer service. So I agree. I think that's fantastic. I want to ask you something
mm-hmm.
here about when you're painting. Because I found this very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You talked a little bit. Maybe you could share a little bit of it again.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody looks at, you know, I'm on your website right now, and that's why I'm asking. And there's the painting of
painting in progress.
The painting of 13th green at Augusta National. And what's really interesting is
mm-hmm.
there's so much going on in the background with the trees and the azaleas
right.
and so forth. When you look at an image like this, where do you start? Where do you begin?
I look at it,
and obviously you're looking through a more experienced eye, but when you've got the photos and you've got the image in mind, but when
mm-hmm.
you start on a painting like this,
mm-hmm.
where in the painting do you start?
Well, you can actually see that if you go to the studio tab and look at
mm-hmm.
the drop-down, you'll see works in progress. guess that's what it is. And you can see a painting from start to finish. There's a number of ones there. You can just pick one you want to look at, and you'll see exactly how it's done. And I start out with just a plain blue line drawing, and then I start usually with the sky and the things that are furthest away and work towards the foreground.
So that's generally how on, I mean, obviously there's differences in every image that you're looking at, but generally that's how you work with, is you sort of work from the furthest to the closest.
Right. Like if you, you know, look
that,
at any, you pick any one and click on it, you'll see all this, all the progress of that painting. And you can make like a slideshow of it.
It's amazing. You know, when you look at through that, and I'm going to, again, we'll give the listeners the website here again in a second. And obviously we want to wait until after the show, after we're done, they can go and check it out. I was just being a little bit nosy, and I wanted to ask you that because it's very interesting. I find it, you know, I'm certainly not going to try my hand at what you're doing here because I'm quite certain it's going to look entirely different than what you have. But it's always interesting to me when I see, trust me, it's going to look much different. But you know, when I look at these images, and it's very, very interesting because it starts off something very, very, what you would think would be simplistic looking. But as you evolve through the various images and you start to see it take shape, it's just amazing. And then when you see the finished product, the amount of detail that obviously went into it and how it sort of progressed, it is very, very interesting in the process. And, you know, was this something that you know, sort of somewhat came naturally? I don't mean, obviously you were involved at an earlier age in artists, but is this a technique that you're taught along the way when you went to school and that and was first learning how to become an artist? How did you learn to do that? Because that's not something that most people looking
evolved.
At a painting.
I'd have to say it evolved. Okay. And the way I paint is not the way you're taught to paint. I paint in sections, which, you know, every teacher tells you to work the whole painting up at once. Well, as you can see, most of that canvas is blank. Each part I do is finished. It's like a process called alla prima, where you're putting all that paint on and working it wet, and it's done before you move on to the next section. So each piece fits into the next piece, basically. It's kind of a weird way of working.
Like it's almost like a jigsaw puzzle, really.
Exactly.
If you think about it, you know, each piece you find, and then you find the next piece, or in your case, you develop and paint the next piece that goes into.
Well, whatever comes
next. It's very interesting.
Yeah, right. It's like, you know, if there's trees in the sky, then the trees have to be in the sky before I get the next section. So it's hard to explain. You have to look at those paintings in progress to see, kind of, you get a general idea of how it's done. And like I said, it's not the way anyone's taught to paint, and most artists even look at it and go, what? They don't quite get it either.
Well, that's
the
probably what
take
separates
a very long,
you.
Yeah, they take a very long time to do, too. I mean, depending on the size, they can take up to 6 months or more.
Wow.
So it's, you know, it's a long process.
Well, I can assure you it would be much longer than 6 months for me. It might be closer to 6 years. And that would still be working on the sky, and I'm sure many people looking at my images would probably still be scratching their head for another couple of years after trying to figure out what it was I was trying to accomplish. But you obviously were very blessed with a wonderful talent. And
well, that
and,
helped.
You know, have been, sure. I mean,
I was born with that, and that was just there. I've always had it. I've always had a color sense. I've always had a perspective sense. So I didn't have to struggle much, you know, to get where I was. And that's why the work constantly evolves. It just building on, you know, what you already know, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, everybody, I think everybody has some skill or what have you very
mm-hmm.
early on, and it's a matter of you know, sort of building that out, as you said, and some people never exercise that particular area,
right.
Unfortunately, and others do. So I want to go back very briefly, if we can, to the AGA or the Academy of Golf Art. You're obviously, guys are very open to accepting new artist members and that. Is there
mm-hmm.
a process? What do they have to go through? If somebody that may be tuning into the show that has, you know, developed
mm-hmm.
Some artistic talent themselves, and particularly in this field of golf,
mm-hmm.
how do they go about becoming a member of the AGA? What's involved in that?
Well, they have to go to the website and make contact and then submit their work. I mean, basically representations of what they're doing. And then we kind of all get together and decide. You know, there's different levels
is there
of membership.
Sure. Are there things that you look for as members, as you're looking at new members? Are there things in the work that you're looking? I mean, for instance, if you've got two people and they're kind of almost exactly the same, does that matter?
It's a skill level,
okay.
Basically. I mean, you're looking for depth and skill and
right.
And imagery, obviously, there's so many aspects of what makes a good painting. You're just looking mm-hmm. for all of that.
Got it. Well, I think that, I think, like I said, what you've done from the very beginning in really opening up this line of, you know, of artistic talent that really
mm-hmm.
has not been seen in the golf industry for a long time is a great gift, not just the actual artwork itself, but just that you've opened a door really for others to walk through. And as I said earlier, you really are a pioneer of golf art, and your repertoire of work and the different groups that you've worked with and continue to work
mm-hmm.
with obviously shows that very, very well. And I know you're very, very proud of what you do, and I know you obviously enjoy
yeah.
that. And even though you said you never set out to get in the golf business, you've certainly
well, it didn't
you've certainly
take me
done
long to decide that it was a good place to be.
Right.
I mean,
well,
I really enjoy
yeah,
the golf people, and I love the different landscape of all the different courses, and it's a really wonderful world, the golf world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
the people
really
appreciate everything I do. It's not like, well, for a while I was working with equine work art, and the difference in the people, it was like, you know, they didn't like anything unless it was their horse or their breed. And
right.
I found that really off-putting. So when I started with the golf, you know, it was like, oh, they love everything you do. It didn't matter if they'd ever played the course even, or it wasn't their particular club. They just appreciated it so much, and I thought, boy, this is great. These are great people.
Well, I think golf has a very unique advantage, if you will, over a lot of other industries and a lot of even other
yeah.
sports. Golf has a very long history,
uh-huh.
you know, hundreds of years, in fact, and it's had so many different people that have you know, from people very, very early on to, you know, the Arnold Palmers and the Jack Nicklaus and,
mm-hmm.
you know, a little bit later on Tiger Woods and some of the young ones coming up now, and even some of the, a lot of the young ladies who have gone on and done things to really change the way we see golf today. And really you're able to capture so much of that in your paintings.
Well, I'll tell you,
even
you
those
know,
that
golf is a discipline and so is art.
Mm-hmm.
And I can
right.
really relate to it on that, even though I don't play the game, I appreciate it on that
mm-hmm.
level. I love watching people play. Love
mm-hmm.
watching the tournaments and seeing what it takes to be a professional golf, you know, player is incredible. It's an
mm-hmm.
amazing, amazing game. You could play at any level. Fantastic.
And I think that's what the appeal is.
Uh-huh.
You know, we all would love, you know, those of us that play would love to, you know, be battling it out on Augusta, St. Andrews or some of the other, you know, Pebble Beach or what have you. But
sure.
the interesting thing is even at the most novice level,
mm-hmm.
you know, you look at little kids and junior programs and things, there's just, you know, it just takes, and we've talked about this many times on my show, you know, it just
mm-hmm.
takes that one well-struck shot to bring somebody back. They could be a terrible golfer overall, but one good shot or one good drive, and it's just enough to keep their interest going. And very few other sports can do that. And
right.
so I think what you're doing, again, being able to capture so much of that is obviously very appealing and has become so for these last several decades. But well, Linda, I want to thank you once again for joining me tonight
mm-hmm.
on Golf Talk Live. I appreciate it very much. I enjoy our conversation. You've got a lot of great insight into what you do and make it very interesting to want to learn more. So for the folks
mm-hmm.
listening, there's two websites I'm going to direct you to. First and foremost, Linda's website, which is harto.com, and it's harto.com.
Yes.
You can see a lot of her great work.
Everyone to sign up for the emails because that's where you get your Guess the Winner contest.
All right. Definitely do that. Sign up for their email while they go there, mm-hmm. harto.com. And then also check out the Academy of Golf Art.
Mm-hmm.
Their website is academyofgolfart.org. If you're somebody that's maybe an artist yourself and you want to find out about how to get your work connected with them, you can go there as well. And just to see some of the other golf artists in addition to Linda. But, Linda, thank you very much once again for joining me this evening on Golf Talk Live. It's a pleasure.
Well,
I enjoyed having you on the show.
Enjoyed it very much.
And
you're
welcome. And much continued success. And I hope you'll come back and join me again in a future show.
Love to.
All right. You
right.
have a great evening and a great weekend. And thank you again.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. That was Linda Harto. She is a world-renowned golf landscape artist. And you can find her on her website at Harto, that's harto.com. You can check out all of her work, and you can actually check out the process. You can see some of the paintings, the work in progress, if you will, on there, some of the paintings that she's done, and see how she, the first few images, and as it goes along from beginning to end, you can see the process that we talked about here tonight on there as well. And don't forget to sign up for their email newsletter, if you will. Get on their mailing list, and you can get a lot of great opportunities there as well. And then don't forget to also go visit the the academyofgolfart.org, their website, to check out some of the other artists as well. But I want to thank the gang, if you will, from Coach's Corner, Tim Kramer, Alicia Larson, and Clint Wright. Thanks, guys, for doing a great job earlier on the show, and I appreciate you tuning in and listening to my conversation with Linda Harto, world-renowned golf landscape artist. I will see you next week for another show, another great panel on Coach's Corner, and another insightful interview with my special guest here on Golf Talk Live. God bless everybody. Be safe and have a great weekend.
Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this week's broadcast of Golf Talk Live. We'd like to thank this week's Coach's Corner panel, and a special thank you to tonight's guest. Remember to join Ted every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. Central on Golf Talk Live. And be sure to follow Ted on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you're interested in being a guest on Golf Talk Live, send Ted an email at ted.golftalklive@gmail.com. This has been a production of the iGolf Sports Network.